Way of Living, Romans class. We're on lesson, I think, what lesson are we on? 14, and we're covering Romans 12 this morning. This is the 29th of January. Okay, that should be on. Morning, everybody. Come on in. Good to see you. I have three books on that I've listed on the whiteboard this morning because I'm going to refer to them. And one of them is already on the bibliography that I gave you in the fall. The other two aren't, but they're definitely related to Romans 12. And seeing as how whole books have been written on one verse, 12:2. We're hardly going to exhaust the potential for learning there. So if you want a little more or to expand the horizons on that, all three of these are good for that. So if you're interested, there you go. You will also maybe want to know that if you're looking ahead, we only have a few lessons left until we're finished for the year. February 19th is our last day here together, and there are enough of us that may want to be together on. We always do something together on the last day. But it's seen as how, it's early, but I'm planning on moving in the summer. And so it just happened to come together and that this was a long, short study. So works for planning purposes. And so Elise is, and her very wonderful people are planning lunch for us on the 19th after class. So if you can join us for our time together, that would be wonderful. I'm just giving you a heads up so you can save the date. If you don't normally do lunch. Let's see. Anything else by way of announcements? I think we're good. So let's ask the Lord to help us here. Lord, thank you so much for preserving this book for us. Hard for us to imagine really what it is for something to be finished and already from the beginning of time, from the foundations of the world, all these people, Paul, the Roman church, us, all in your mind as you were moving Paul to write these things. And so for your glory, as you have said it again this morning, it's about living for you, making the most of our opportunity to be everything we can be for you. So teach us well, please. I do pray that we won't look at this long list of wonderful potential points of growth for us and just be overwhelmed, but rather to see how much you have for us, that you will equip us to do for you. What a privilege it is to be part of building your kingdom, something that's so far beyond us, really, and to complete expansive view of it. But we have our part. What a joy it is to think that you would use each one of us. So do that, please, this morning. Because we love you, because you are worthy, and because we don't want to waste a moment of any opportunity that you've given us, including this morning and all that's here. In Jesus' name, Amen. Well, how about last week? What was it? You have a takeaway?
Offer your bodies as living sacrifice. He made us, and we are his for his purpose and glory.
Okay, that's this week. Isn't it? Well, you can answer the next one. Francis, just, yeah, okay, we know your verse for number two. How about last week, though, before we jump to the living sacrifice, is something from okay, go ahead, Carter.
Page 125, I was reminded, me who likes to do everything myself, does only what in the second full paragraph, an attitude of self-sufficiency, that this attitude cuts people off from the mercy of God. Those who insist on asserting their own righteousness do not receive the righteousness that comes by
faith. I kind of can't have both. Good like reminders.
I've been like that since I was teeny. I told my cousin I wanted to do it myself. Leave me alone.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, that probably falls in the category in this week's lesson of thinking of yourself, have a sober mind in thinking of yourself. Realistically, you probably enjoy the curse of competence, Carter, and it's not a bad thing when it's channeled well. Something else from just last week, Jane.
This implies that we should give to God whatever bears God's image. God has stamped his image on each one of us. What then do we owe God? Ourselves. We owe God everything we are.
Okay. Another lead-in for today. And Francis, we know your favorite verse. I mean, unless you've got another one, but I'm on today's lesson now. What do you love? There's a lot of verses here that you missed might want to pull out as a especially good one. Thank you, Kathy.
All right, it's a classic, John 15:5. I am the vine, you are the branches. If a man remains in me and I in him, he will bear much fruit, because apart from me, you can do nothing.
Nothing. There you go, Carter. You're working hard, but nope. Uh-huh. Okay.
So I'm reminded, even though, you know, the curse of competence.
Uh-huh.
Perhaps,
yep.
Another verse on that 125 says, God never interferes with human responsibility. Nothing God has ever said or done will ever infringe on our ability to make free will choices. Yet, and this is the paradox, nothing we do as human beings can ever frustrate God's sovereign plan.
It really is is just something to ask God about further explanation when we get our glorified brain.
I just wish he sent emails.
Or texts, yes, that would be helpful. I want one of those USB sticks, you know, just stick it in my ear or something and get the job done. If you're ready, let's go to second day where we were looking at chapter 12, all of verse 1. So, the end of Romans 11, we were left with this understandably amazed look at God's sufficiency in his mind, because he's everything. Paul urges us in the first verse, what?
Be
present our bodies a living and holy sacrifices. It doesn't say by our will. It says by His mercy.
In the light, I think some of the versions will say, in the light of God's mercy, and there is the therefore. So it's, and well, notice it says, I believe in all of our versions, I urge you, brothers, he's talking to redeemed people. It's not a list of to-dos that anybody else can really embrace in the same way. Brothers, and this is a church that was probably having some issues with how to work out their maturity, because when all was said and done, they had some tribal issues that made it difficult for them to like each other sometimes. So they're going to get a little more prompting in this chapter. Part B, what do you learn from backwards? You know, we already had it, chapter 6:13. Just the intro on the whole topic. What'd you have?
It was instruction to not offer our bodies to sin as instruments of wickedness, but to God as instruments of righteousness.
It's that initial idea of the living sacrifice thing that we can do that. What do you learn? Oh, yeah, that was B. And God views the sacrifice now as what? I'm on question two, by the way.
Active worship. Yeah,
and don't forget the
spiritual.
And there's another word I'm looking for. It's holy, reasonable, or logical. But remember, because he's going toward the mind. Yeah, I mean, that's where we're going in verse 2, to be transformed by the renewing of your mind. So he is saying, based on everything that's up to this point, this is just reasonable. It's not a blind leap of faith. It's reasonable. It's logical in light of everything else. God, remember, he's merciful to whom he's merciful. Unbelievable as it is, I was predestined, I was chosen, and in the light of God's mercy, and what you know of him, and everything Paul's already given them, us, of him, totally depraved, completely irresponsible, called by God, and now more than conquerors, all of those things stacking up to make it the most reasonable thing that we can possibly do is give it all to him. Okay, so that wanted to capitalize on that. And he calls the offering of our body what? You already mentioned that in part C.
Reasonable service.
Reasonable, or how about act of worship? It's a worship thing. And he actually is going back to what would be maybe a more recent reference to them, but the sacrificial tabernacle terminology that the Jews carried with them all the time. You know, there were different sacrifices that they made in the temple. Their set out and explained in Leviticus. There are different ones for sin offerings. But just to be, I'm not sure, I mean, hair splitty about it, he's not talking about sin offerings per se, because Jesus already did that. So you can't crawl up on the altar and offer something for sin, because it's your reference, Carter. I hope I'm not going to use you for the rest of the year for I'll try not to, but that's right, countdown. Well, I mean, the whole point that he's made is it's mercy. But There is the very first offering that's described in Leviticus. Isn't specifically the sin offering, it's the burnt offering. It was the whole animal. It had to be perfect, blemish, i.e. holy, and is offered to the Lord, and none of it is eaten. It's completely consumed, flayed open, which isn't not a great thought, but it is totally consumed. It's expensive, it's personal, but it's the picture here. This is the living offering of your whole open, total self to be consumed by the Lord. And I mean, there was a costly offering then. It's a costly offering all through life. But God knows how to encourage us in that. And we go to John 4 for part B, which relates to the previous comment about that being an act of worship. What's the line thereafter there for just a tie-in?
God is spirit, and those who worship him must worship him in spirit and in truth.
So it's still a worship thing. And throughout Romans, Paul, question 4, has shown us that it's not what we accomplish, but it's God's amazing mercy. And James takes us just a little further in how that works out with James 2. What'd you have as a some elaboration on that? It's supposed to predictably produce something. Okay, and then it personalizes it on question 5, where we've accepted Christ as our Savior, assuming so, but there are places, I think most of us, when you take the microscope to our lives and thinking processes, have some hesitancy on giving God access to every single corner. And it asks about our worship time, but fail to allow our life to be completely transparent before him. I think it's more for our personal reflection. If you have any thoughts on that? We're going to verse 2 with the third day, and that's where I is mostly where the books on the board come from. I was just saying last night to Steve and I. We're talking about this, and I really like Romans, but I can see why it's hard to teach. It's just known to be hard. For one thing, as we see here, there's the problem of editing. All of these are books written on one verse. And I mean, I've got 20 minutes to figure out what's the important thing. But I mean, whoever put our lesson together had to edit. And it's quite challenging. And some of the things we really won't exhaust, will we, until we meet the Lord face to face? Because we will be able to, of course, we'll probably know by then, it won't even be an issue. But what were you thinking about the Jews? I'm not sure. It's quite something. So moving into verse 2, with that in mind, our limitations are partly for time and just because it's really so much bigger than we are. What does God ask of us in 2a?
Not to be conformed to the world.
Okay. And it's clearly a don't don't do this. It's a mandate. Let me see what I've got here. We're going to look at conformed, but be transformed. Conforming, if you think about the word, is outward pressure that pushes something to a shape. Whereas transforming, and that's coming up, the word, the Greek word comes from the word for metamorphosis, like we would apply to, say, the caterpillar that becomes the butterfly. It's a change, a total change, and it's a transforming change like that happens from the inside out, which fits with the picture that Paul is working on us to get the image of. Don't be pushed into, and the word world is sometimes, depending on the version you're using, but the idea is of the times, the age. Don't be conformed to the time that you're living in. What's the trendy thought? What's the thing that goes, that makes the world go round now? Anyway, we're going to expand on that, learning about the pattern of the age, the world, from these verses. Ephesians has one example. What do you have to remind us of what's in Ephesians 2, chapter 2? It also says we were what?
Disobedient.
The point being, you were one thing, but you have the option to be, and God is working on and has paid for us to be not that. And 1 John says it a little differently. How do you have it from 1 John? And then we go on to, for everything in the world, and it lists some things that are typical, right? What do you have for that?
The desires of the flesh, the desires of the eyes and the pride of life is not from the Father, but it's from the world. You know, those are the same things that Satan tempted Eve with.
The styles have changed. The mode has changed. It's much more, I want to say, just sophisticated now. What I mean, the style of this age that is that's pressing us all the time, the media. I mean, it's what's normal, what's expected. Even the politics. You know, the language, the meanings of words start to change. There are just so many things that we would have no trouble saying, oh yeah, I can see that. That's putting some pressure on. But the thing is, we live in that. So we can't, and we probably aren't going to change that so much as we would just change our degree of sensitivity to it so that we can be bolstered in other ways. So that was 1 John. Instead of living and thinking as the world thinks, the transformation is going to change our mind first, probably the mind, because what we think is what we act on. We learn about transformation from, I was going to read 2 Corinthians. It's a good reminder. I should have actually read it up in, I think, maybe the very first question, got what God asks for us. But anyway, what's 2 Corinthians 3 say about our transformation?
And we all who with unveiled faces contemplate the Lord's glory are being transformed into his image with ever increasing glory, which comes from the Lord who is the Spirit.
And and you know, Paul wrote both. He wrote Romans and he wrote, wrote 1 Corinthians, 2 Corinthians. And it's interesting to see how many things that are actually, there's common ground, but he's also thinking of the people he's writing to. And so many references for 1 and 2 Corinthians are written with a mind. I mean, he really cares about these people, but they are the most messed up people. So in this case in 2 Corinthians, it's just interesting to see that he's saying God is doing this. The Lord's glory, we are being transformed. We are. But then in Romans, maybe they're a little more teachable, but in Romans he is saying, so there is this sense, God is in this for sure, but you do have a choice in how malleable and how much you want this and what you're willing to, the degree of sacrifice you're willing to take into your life. And 2 Peter says it differently, but we can take a look at that real quick. What's that say?
His divine power has granted to us everything pertaining to life and godliness through the true knowledge of him who called us by his own glory and excellence. For by these he has granted to us his precious and magnificent promises, that by them we might become partakers of the divine nature, having escaped the corruption that's in the world.
One of my favorite examples, and I actually had planned to bring that up in the closing talk, because it, and I mean, but I know enough to know it doesn't always go as planned. I planned to mention that in the closing talk. We'll see, but his divine power given us everything we need to do this, basically, all of our life. And but it's if you go to read just a little further in 2 Peter, then he goes on to say, make every effort. You're just gonna take that USB stick and put it in. Make every effort. And there's this progression of growth that is each one just a little. It can come quickly, but it's, and the final one, coincidentally, using the term loosely, is love. It's no accident that love comes, I think, a lot of times at the end of a string of things, because you really just can't do it without, not the way that God's talking about it. Without a great deal of health, of help and maturity. In Ephesians, we have another reference. What do you have from Ephesians? The transformed life.
God gave us the apostles, the prophets, the evangelists, the pastors, the teachers, to equip his people for works of service.
He really doesn't just throw us out there so that he can have some comic relief in heaven. He has given us the means to get there with his help. And 1 Thessalonians says it again. Another.
Encourage each other and build each other up.
Because nobody's arrived. Uh-huh. All righty. And we get this idea, I think it's clear at this point, from the personal question. I mean, we're reflecting on this. Chuck Swindoll, in his commentary, called this God's giving it, but our working with it, he just calls it a cooperative command. The command is given, like make every effort, but it's also open to us to work with it or to choose not to today. In any case, and it asks us about our involvement with the Word and with the other believers who are encouraging us and listening to the truth presented, and just some personal reflection. I can't read a chapter like this without having some little okay.
I could have done fill in the blank, you know. I could have done more. I could have.
Or acted on something that was maybe a prompt, but I didn't have time, or even worse, I just didn't want to, or didn't like the person. Not me, huh? All right. We're not perfect. We're just encouraging each other. Okay. And as we are changed, our thinking is changed, and what will we be able to do? Okay, and it's, well, how is God's will described? Good, pleasing, maybe mine said, perfect. Wouldn't it be nice if you could just sort of, well, ask an email, you know? What about this one? What do you think for dinner tonight, Lord? it's not always black and white. I mean, that's what we're all. The Ten Commandments are black and white. We know that. I've got trouble with those sometimes, but it does suggest that there's learning involved. We are in the process of hearing, believing, applying, and apply becomes experiential knowledge, which is really another way to say wisdom, isn't it? You can be smart and have a lot of knowledge and be really unwise. We probably know some people like that. Even they're smart people, but as long as it stays head knowledge, it's pretty much ivory tower philosophical rambling. And when it's become experiential is when it starts to be really usable. Isn't it sad that the old age we're the wise people and then we're too old to do anything with it? And the young people think they know it all anyway, so well, God knows. I mean, it's his program, but we are cautioned in verse 3. Let me just make sure I just covered everything that seemed appropriate at the time. No, wait. We're not on the fourth day, are we? Question 5. I kind of think when we're afraid of God's will, it's because we haven't. I mean, the people who are particularly haven't tried it and found it. I mean, the more you've experienced God's working out the right way, the best way, the easier it is to know that he's trustworthy. It's not something to be fearful of. It says why, if we were supposed to be at least on this question, thought about our own areas where we're afraid and what we might do or why. Did you have any quick thoughts on that, Carter?
Denise, it's Judy.
Hold on.
Okay.
Carter.
Oh, go ahead. You can
no, you take you first.
I think in some ways when we might feel like we've been called, we might hesitate because we feel like our self-expectations will not meet a standard that we would aim for.
It's a lot of area for hesitancy. And so you were going to say?
I feel like Moses sometimes, like, God, are you sure you got the right person?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, well, we're in good company. Moses, Gideon, how many other people, Paul, you think about where he came from. And Judy, you were going to say?
Well, when you know that, I learned the hard way to listen, because if you don't listen, then it doesn't end up very well.
The school of hard knocks. That's a good, very good teacher. Yeah, thank you. All righty. Now we can go to the fourth day, I suppose. What's Paul caution us about in verse 3? Just the first part.
Don't think you're better than you really are.
Yeah. No, don't think too highly of yourself. But what type of judgment?
Sober
judgment. Notice he never says, he doesn't say be humble, which is how we tend to think of the opposite of think too much of yourself. But when you really get to, hair splitting over it, it's more just don't be thinking about yourself. To be humble and worrying about being humble enough is also kind of self-oriented. I don't know if Paul even thought, I better not say don't be humble. It's just that God orchestrates exactly how these words get placed, and that's just an observation. So got the sober judgment, and that's the one, is that the one that says in the measure of faith? In the measure of faith God's given you, I think. We tend to read that as a measure of faith being you have more faith or less faith. So think of yourself sober-minded related to how much faith you have. But actually, think about this. If it's not a measure of how much, it's you have faith. Faith is the measure. Because you have faith, you can think soberly and let your faith impress or let your faith influence how you're thinking of yourself. Like, for example, if you go to measure something, you say you're going to use a ruler to measure it. The ruler doesn't change. The ruler was the measure. Your faith is the measure. You have the faith. So the faith will help you to think soberly. See, this, it's not just a hair-splitting word difference. There is the implication that somehow you will be able to think soberly about yourself better if you're smarter or if you have more faith. But that's actually not what's being conveyed as much as you have it. So you can do it, and God will help us direct our thinking that way. Anyway, thought you might find that interesting. I did. Are we on two? Question two? Oh, yes, and we have sober. It was looked up in the dictionary where the first, just discount the first couple that mean not drunk. And then what comes after that is probably what we're after. Did you?
There was unhurried, calm, restrained, rational, marked by sedate or seriously, earnestly, thoughtful character or demeanor. This really got me. Temperate, moderate, and serious. I was so convicted on every spot.
It's how you think of yourself. If you're really good at something, then you know you're pretty good at it, and thank God he's given you that talent, and you just want to use it for him. You don't go around saying, well, you know, I'm trying to figure out how to pass this off and be humble. Too much effort on how I look. Just think soberly. God has given me experience or a certain package, and I just want to use it for him. Whatever, you know, it's that kind of thinking. Question four: what should be taken into consideration as we consider ourselves? Belle, did we do this? How come I feel like we did it?
Because she sort of covered it.
That's probably why. All right. Well, I did. Sorry. Any burning issues additional? Let's go to the challenge then, 2 Thessalonians. Does everybody have a measure of faith? Not according to them, not according to their definition of faith, not according to the biblical definition of the measure of faith. However, we all have faith. I mean, everybody does. They have faith that the car's going to get us home and, you know, all those kinds of things, but not this kind of faith. And okay. Humans, personally, we don't even often stop and think, is this my feeling or is this what I know? I mean, but we do run on our feelings, don't we? Frequently as our default mode. But it does help to remember, in view of his mercy, all these things, God's abilities. I think the final question, really, as their lead in here was then, what do you do with this? Do I tend, and this is just for personal reflection, but which way do I tend to err, and what am I going to do about it? Marcia.
I read a little book by Tim Keller about self-forgetfulness.
Mm-hmm.
And
it's a pamphlet, isn't it? I have it.
Yes,
I actually do have it.
It's real easy mm-hmm. to read. But one of the things it says that I thought was good was, if you have a gift, be as pleased about that as you are when you observe that gift or another gift in someone else. And be just as pleased that you can offer that. Be pleased that you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
Like you might be pleased that you can do that, this mm-hmm. person can mm-hmm. do something else.
It kind of falls into that category that's coming a little later. Rejoice with those who rejoice. That you to be pleased for others' blessings.
You don't have to be understated about what God has done, what gifts He's done for you. Enjoy that you can offer those as much as you enjoy somebody else offering.
And that therein also we have that reminder, just a couple, you know, the verse right before this, don't get full of yourself. don't be thinking it's got anything to do with you. Mm-hmm.
You know, in the one back up, 12:3, mm-hmm. the example it gave was the clay pots,
mm-hmm.
which I had never thought about. I mean, I knew they had clay pots, and I knew they kept different times of things, and but I did not know that they kept the garbage and human waste in them, and that's what Paul says, that the clay pots remind him of, that we're not weak, we're strong like that pot, but we are not to be over exalted.
Well, and what question were you thinking of that on, Rose? I'm just curious. Question five. Makes you different from any.
How does 1 Corinthians 4:7 expand on 12:3?
I had not made that connection.
But in Corinthians, that's what it says.
Okay.
About the clay pots.
All right. Well, they had to put the garbage in something.
My word, I am just as bad.
Well, when you look at where we came from, there, it's always a little bit of a stretch to just to try to come up with the description for how bad we really are, and how amazing it is that God would use us. He does require that. I mean, he cleansed us, thankfully. Okay. I just hadn't connected that fact with the difference in the use of the pots, but I could see that.
My Bible doesn't have clay pot in in 1 Corinthians 4:7.
Does it? Who makes you different from anyone else? Is probably what they're talking about. Is it like a footnote or something?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. 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 Who makes you different than anybody else? You're a clay pot like everybody else. Well, yeah. And we have the potter and the clay, and you don't get to choose, and the potter makes you into the vessel he wants. I can see the connection in the concept. And then, of course, the real question is how do you tend to look at your own self? Paul is still addressing how we should view ourselves, and we get down to that section in Romans, the next really, oh, I don't know, not quite 10 verses, but 4 to 11, and the comparison. Now, we're moving out of pots, and what's the main thing? The comparison in 4 and 5.
Physical body.
It's a body, which we all can relate to. I'll have one. And how does it explain the value we should place on ourselves and other believers?
Well, I think we're all the same, but we have a different function. It's like, I don't know where my husband found this a long time ago, but he was talking about that if everybody can't be the eyes.
Oh, yeah.
And everybody can't be the ears.
Mm-hmm.
Because that's the two main things that people think about. But you need people that are huggers that give encouragement.
Okay,
and
yeah.
You need feet that carries the message.
It all works together.
You get mm-hmm. on your knees to pray. So you're one body, but you're functioning. Your role is different.
I feel like we should consider everybody in the church as valuable as our body parts.
Well, and you don't even think of the value. I mean, I don't know about, I mean, I don't wake up every morning and thank the Lord that I have a toenail or, I mean, you know, just the littlest things. But I'll tell you what, you drop something on your toe real hard and you're thinking about your toe all the time. It takes weeks to get past that. 6 months to grow a whole new toenail, but I mean, maybe. And everything is going fine, and then all of a sudden you find out you've got arthritis in your hip and you need a hip replacement. Thank you, Lord, that they're there. But, you know, you're not thinking about this stuff, and we don't pay particular attention to it, but God knows when it doesn't work. We really need it. And so it is. It's a great comparison that Paul hit on with the body. Because we all can understand this, and did we just do this part B, right?
Mm-hmm.
How well, and the value we should place on ourselves and other believers, have we kind of covered it?
Yes.
I think so. And so we're given faith, but what else? What else? Specific gifts, and then we're listing each gift and what Paul says should be done with it. There's just not long. Well, who'll run us through these? Well, actually, let's just bounce around. Who's got the first one?
Prophecy.
Prophesying, and what's it? What's you're supposed to do with it? All right, let him use it in a proportion to his faith. I think I have here. What's the next one?
Serve.
And let him serve. Then the next one?
Teaching.
It's pretty straightforward. Let him teach. Encouraging. Oh, I'm sorry. I'm just reading ahead of my...
Encouraging.
Let him encourage. The next one?
Contributing.
All right. And contributing has liberally or generously. The next one? What was it? And that is?
With diligence.
All right, with diligence. And the next one? All righty.
And that was the thing that you use it with cheerfulness.
Cheerfully.
Cheerful giver.
Yeah, a cheerful giver, a cheerful, merciful person. Mm-hmm. It's not an exhaustive list. I think you all know that. There are a couple of others, but it is helpful here. So as we are, yeah, what are we to do with any of the gifts? All of them.
Use them.
Particularly from 1 Peter. I'm on question 3, right?
Each should use whatever gifts he's received to serve others, joyfully administering God's grace in various forms.
I just put that the whole point is to serve others. I mean, that's, you're in the body, you do what you're supposed to do. All right, to serve the body. And some of the commentators include that first Peter as another list of gifts. They say it's speaking and serving are there, if you want to call it that. And then why are we to do this in 1 Peter 4:11?
That God will be glorified.
Thank goodness. Okay. It doesn't say that even anywhere that I know of, that even the gifts that are mentioned in the Bible, even that is an exhaustive list of gifts. God does anoint us as well to do the things that he calls us to do, and that may be a gift at the moment. Don't you, when you're buying gifts for people, you kind of think in terms of the person that, I mean, that's the thing. What would they like? What phase of life are they in? People give me cat stuff. I really like, I don't know why. My kids, Christmas time gave me like a t-shirt, but it's like down to my knees, and it's the cat's pajamas. You know, it's got cats jumping all over it. Well, I'm going to have it cut off because I don't, you know, all those things get tangled up. But people give me cat things. They give me blue and white dishes just because I like blue and white dishes. It's with a degree of thoughtfulness and affection and intentionality. When God gives you a gift, would we think it would be any less? He knows how he's made you and me, what talents he's given us, what our inclinations are, all of our situation in life, who we married or not, our children or not, all of this stuff of us. And the gifts are very personal. Just seems to make sense that we would want to know it if we possibly can, and use it with affection. You know, I take out those cat pajamas. Oh, they're so cute. I mean, there is that, isn't there? For those gifts that are well placed, and I think God certainly is going to well place the gifts that he gives us. As we share with others, what should our attitude be? All right, a new nuance here.
Loving, devoted to one another in love. Honor others above ourselves. Serve the Lord with zeal.
And that the first line there. Not to be missed. Love must be sincere. All those things. Oh, gosh. It means the word sincere had at that time also, it's probably a closer connection, and we think of what it had to do with drama and the masks. And so don't pretend to be what you're not. All of these things can be done with or accomplished as a grinding duty, joyless, rather carried with a sense of self-sacrifice that needs to be appreciated. There's a difference between doing it sincerely and doing it because you just kind of can't escape it and you feel like you've gotta be that nice person or whatever. But that's not really the goal of the spirits, where the spirit's maturing us to be in the way that we do loving things. And Corinthians, 1 Corinthians says the attitude's going to be displayed in these different ways in our life. Great. If we didn't feel like we're inept now, we get it here. Sincerely, how's this going to look?
Love is patient, kind, does not envy, does not boast, is not proud, not rude, not self-seeking, not easily angered, keeps no record of wrong, does not delight in evil, but rejoices with the truth. It always protects, always trusts, always hopes, always persists.
It's a great aspiration. Oh, God help us. We're commanded to do it, but it does admit, question five, we really can't. It's not a gift. It's not even a desire for us in us sometimes. I mean, really. But we do learn. In Romans 5, what's Paul remind us there? 5:5. He has given us more than we have on our own. We'll grow into it. In Galatians 5, how's it put there?
Gives us the fruit of the Spirit. Love, joy, peace, forbearance, kindness, goodness, faithfulness, gentleness, and self-control.
Fruit just grows. Mm-hmm. And how about John 15:5? We've had a reference to that already. Kathy, was that yours? Okay. All righty. And it is a thought-provoking chapter because there's a lot listed here to just run through, but also to think about. There's reason why we would read this maybe more than once in our lifetime. We are differentiating here between consecration, which is what happens, you know, when you give your life to Christ. I'm saying, I'll be yours. You can set me apart, clean me up. And sanctification, which is the transforming part, it takes a lifetime. So one happens once. You present yourself, if you will, the living sacrifice. I mean, you can keep reminding yourself that you've done that. I know I've done that. But the sanctification, well, it's ongoing. God's not finished with us. So we've got this to-do list that Paul's given us. He's told us all these things that our sanctification or the transforming is going to look like. What three things are we told to do in verse 12? Okay. What can you do to help yourself in this? Part B.
Stay in the Word.
Trust
in the Lord.
Trust.
Prayer.
Prayer. That's big. I mean, in the Word, you know what to pray for. And we're instructed to do what in verse 13?
Share with those in need and practice hospitality.
Mm-hmm. And how do you keep doing these things in your own life? Well, we've got this reference to this little book that they have published through Joy of Living on hospitality. And then it just, which is sometimes listed as a gift, but here we just have, just do it, you know? And what are we told in verse 14? Is it possible then to accept by God's grace? Well, verse 14, what's it say? Well, it's not getting any easier, is it? All righty. And is it possible to do this without God's grace to you? I think most of us would say no. At the very best, without God's grace, it's going to be that hypocritical, or I'll do it because I'm a nice person. And besides, somebody might be having their camera on this. Body cam or something. Well, we understand. For the last like five verses, there's this list of practical instruction, actions that we choose to cultivate, because in the light of God's mercy, it's the logical thing to do. Some of those things, who'll give us a couple?
Rejoice with them that rejoice, and weep with them that weep. Mm-hmm. Be of the same mind. Set your mind on high things, but condescend to things that are lowly. Be not wise in your own conceits. Render to no man evil for evil.
Well,
to do what is right.
That's enough for a lifetime, isn't it? Be careful to do what's right. This is the passage. We're really not at the end, are we, yet? If your enemy...
We've got to live at peace with everyone.
That phrase, though, it's interesting. It is an interesting little phrase before that. If it's possible, as far as it depends on you, which implies that it isn't always possible, and it may not depend on you. Some of these issues involve more than just you, and there's not really anything you can do about it. But
and I love the phrase they put in here, to leave room for God's wrath.
Uh-huh, there you go. There's a lot of biblical inference there. Is this the one? I'm sure it is. It talks about heaping burning coals on your enemy's head. Be kind to him, because he'll heap burning coals. Now, that's a weird one, isn't it? Well, nobody knows exactly for sure. I'll just tell you what the thoughts are. I mean, there's a few main ones on what this could mean. It probably doesn't mean to be nice to him so that God will punish him even more. Like, I'll show you, that isn't leaving room for God's wrath. That's kind of vengeful, and it just doesn't fit with everything else. But it's a pretty common way that people have, in the past at least, understood it. The other possibility, there's two others that are main ones, that your kindness or our kindness to somebody would cause them to feel guilty and feel shame and just be kind of intimidated. The other one is related, but just a little different, because the idea is that being kind to someone in such an unexpected way might be the way that would reach them, and that, I mean, what you have they would want, that it is so appealing to say, oh, the way to Jesus.
I also heard that if somebody's fire goes out, it's very important that they get a source.
It is. There's just culturally, that was especially important.
Give them fire, something they need.
I think they carried it, and sometimes, you know, people have carried it on their head, and so it would be, you know, but all that to say, nobody knows for sure what Paul was thinking about, but we don't know for sure on something. We'll have to ask him. That was a weird one. What'd you choose that one for? Because we weren't exactly sure. But I doubt very much if we're going to be needing to know that in order to get to heaven. So we're probably in pretty good shape if we wrestle the others to the ground anyway. Let's go to the bathroom or get our coffee or whatever within 5 minutes. Can you do that? I'm going to take this, turn my tape off for the moment. Getting back, I got the tape on again. I don't know how it was in all the whole country, but back when I was in high school, which was a long time ago, they were just starting to get with the whole teaching you how to drive with driver's ed in high school and all that. So I remember that. We had to sit through a certain number of classes that happened after school. We've signed up for driver's ed. This is before we turned like 15, because you could get your permit then. So you took driver's ed, and they had classes after school that talked about all that you needed to know in order to understand the driver's manual, and we had films that were supposed to scare us, you know, don't drink and drive because there's the burning fireball and all these things that they put in our head, and then we finished with that, and then the next phase was we would go out to a car. There were usually like three kids in the car and one teacher, different teacher than was teaching in the classroom, braver probably, it was sitting on the other side, the passenger side, with their, he had a brake, too. So there were two brakes that was a set up car, you know, with a fixed. And even when we got out to the car, there was still a lot of talking before anybody turned the motor on. So they filled us with the information, but then the understanding is we had to drive. When our kids got to that age, we were living in a whole different state, but the concept was the same. They had driver's ed at school, and then, well, somebody figured out that they could make money by making the parents pay for private driving lessons. So you only got that if you signed up to pay for it, which we did. Oh, yeah. So we had the same thing going on. You learn in the classroom, then you drive with your parents or whoever else is willing to put their life on the line because we didn't have a car with two brakes. And so we sent him out that far and then you know, hope for the best. And we were practicing with them and that kind of thing. We all know that you don't just become a driver just because you turned 15 or 16. Everybody knows that. We wouldn't want to be out on the road with somebody who thought that. Well, in the terms of this week's lesson, we go from at chapter 12 in Romans, we just got our driver's permit. We have, in light of God's mercies, which have all been unpacked academically, this is what you were, this is what you are, this is what is the logical head knowledge, place to land, now get driving. And all of a sudden, we have all these, do this, don't do this, live like this, love like this. It's all because you got the permit. Now you've got to use it. And you'll get to be a better driver the more that you do. When we studied Ephesians some years ago, a few years ago in this class, I think it was from Sinclair Ferguson. I got the phraseology, but I have remembered it. And he said something like this: God's indicatives always precede his imperatives. God's indicatives precede his imperatives. An indicative is what's indicated. It's the fact. And an imperative, you understand, an imperative sentence has an exclamation point at the end. It's, you know, do this. So we have had all the indicatives up to 12, but now we are just getting a boatload of imperatives. This is how it's going to look in life. As you are mentally, all your life, processing the indicatives or the facts of what is. And one of the first things to note in chapter 12 that do or don't is that don't be conformed to this age, to the times, which I'm just going to say is automatic. It's like the salmon swimming upstream has to decide it's time to turn around and be different and go the other direction. The stream is always going to take us downhill. We will always be conformed unless something in our mind says, take a pause, think about it differently, in light of God's mercies, all these things. You increasingly begin to do that, but it's practiced and it's a maturing thing. We have to intentionally reverse the order, or the order is always going to conform us. It's doing it all the time. All the time. I guess you would say the beat goes on, but we can stop listening to that music and assess whether it's what we really want to listen to at the moment, or if it fits with what we know of what God's about in our life. There are a lot of things Christians are called to be biblically, lots of things. We're called to be salt and light, but what if the salt loses its saltiness? Then it's good for nothing. And so how do we do this? How do we live as thinking people? And Paul really doesn't tell us how. I mean, you've got this whole list of all these things that could be, if you're new to this and you just come to chapter 12 and you're trying to do it, where do I begin? I mean, it's a lot. It's too much. It's depressing because I'm so not that. Well, the little book, John Stott's little book, for starters, it's one that I put on the board, Your Mind Matters. A couple of the commentators just noted that. I haven't read it, but apparently in that, he listed six areas. I mean, I know you like lists, so I'll just tell you what he listed as sort of a starting point, because really, it's just a daily process of working this into our thinking and habits, and it becomes us. But the things that need some intentional checks, we're on it constantly, is worship. Instead of just being conformed to, it's not just being there, which is nice, but it's engaging our mind. Are you thinking about the hymns that you're singing? How does that fit with the scripture? Am I paying attention? Worship. The other one is faith. You can't really have faith in God's word if you don't know God's word. So, I mean, how would you know what was transforming if you weren't exercising it? holiness, which is basically sanctification, growing in maturity. It takes time. I can't just expect that God's going to do skywriting here, but the more that I expose myself to those transforming things and practices, the more wise I become. It doesn't mean I have a high IQ. It means I've got the permit and I've driven a little bit. We seek guidance. They're biblical principles that we can follow, and we begin to see how these things play together rather than just pulling a verse out or saying, God told me this because I ran into this verse today. I think it was Isaac Newton. I didn't look it up. I'm pretty sure it was Isaac Newton that said something like, if I've gone for, you know, he was the guy that, gravity. But, I mean, really, that's the main thing, but he's much more than that. Anyway, very smart man. But he said, if I've gone further, it's because I've stood on the shoulders of giants. I mean, smart people, wise people, know to listen to other wise people. I mean, it's just that's that are being transformed as well. And evangelism, how can you explain the truths of God if you don't understand them? The only way you understand them is to have been transformed by them yourself. And in ministry, how can I discern what God's leading me to do? How can I know my spiritual gifts? How do I go about accomplishing, even working those out in a body of Christ without engaging my mind with the Lord? Instead of just taking the easiest route, which is pretty much the path of least resistance, and, well, I'll just wait until I get some skywriting or something. We can most of us grow in this. The book is little. I think it was like 200 pages or something like that. So each one gets some attention. But it still goes back to, it's helpful to see how to pay attention to these particular things, but we tend to think, well, when God says I should be transformed by the renewing of my mind, maybe it means, I think this is what most people initially think, that it means, remember the old, I don't know how, I mean, you probably recognize it. I don't smoke, and I don't chew, and I don't go with girls that do. It's some kind of a restrained, structural, what I do, but the transforming is something inside. It's not what I do is peripheral to that. So it's not external. It's an internal thing. What I do, how I do it, is Nike figured it out, didn't they? Just do it. We pick up the book and we read it and we think about it and we get our permit and we get out there with the instructor, and, you know, there's going to be some bumps in the road. We'll make mistakes and we learn from mistakes. And the mistakes teach us, even the mistakes teach us that God is faithful. He's good for what he told us. He can even make the mistakes that are painful something good. Because I've told you some of these things, some of the stuff that had to be learned after the permit. The stranger's stone wall that got the car run through it. The very first day of the permit, I'm at home at the kitchen table, the police call me. I'm calling about about the wall that your husband and daughter ran through. Well, I don't know. Well, they haven't even come home from the motor vehicle department yet. But it was a learning point. And somebody came a little too close to one of those metal posts and took off the side mirror. That was really close. And you think it wouldn't be that much of a thing, but they're electrically connected to lots of other stuff. It was kind of a big deal. And then there was the time that somebody backed out of the driveway in a real hurry because it was finals class day and bumped into the car that was parked across the street, our neighbors across the street, and assessed with all the other girls in the car that were also in a hurry that it was just a tap and they didn't see anything, so they went driving on ahead. And that cost a lot of babysitting money over about 3 years. And one time, our son, who had the permit and who had had the lessons and who had been out with his dad, I thought, I've got this. He was well on his way. He was driving on, doing just fine on a road that was pretty close to our house. And an elderly gentleman, noticed that there was something on the other side. We were coming one way, they were coming the other way. The elderly gentleman looked away from the street and ran into our car head on, nearly totaled the car. Our son did nothing. There was no problem. It took me at least 10 years before I could get back in the car with that child. I'm not on purpose necessarily, but you know, when you get in to drive and it's a parent and a kid, the parent usually drives. So he went through high school, he went through college, he got married, and I remembered then when I got in the car, he was driving somewhere because they were married, you know, and had their life. I thought, oh, this is the first time I've been in the car with him since, you know. Well, I'm not sure what we learned, but there was lots to be thankful for. Nobody got hurt. The guy got out of the car right away. I thought he looked like he was about 100. Of course, I was 45, so you know, it's all relative. He said right away, it was my fault. It was totally my fault. I mean, there were just a lot of things that were just, you learn, you know. Our son was there. The police are saying it's okay. It's not a problem. And I mean, a car, we could drive it. We got it home. There's bumps in the road. It's a long process, this transforming thing. Some of the transformations are going to involve the potholes and the speed bumps and the clipped off mirrors. And we learn and we become wise. And it brings to mind, I think, that passage in Ephesians where Paul talks about the outer part of it that's wasting away because we're getting old. But the inner part, that's feeding something in our spirit that's invaluable and eternal. You know, you look at the rest of the chapter and all of these things that Paul lists, you could be overwhelmed or you could just look at where he's going with all of us and say, isn't it wonderful that he has such a high view of me that I'm worth training? Ultimately, you know, each one of these people, probably like us today, each one of us, you know, you read through the list and something hits you. I mean, because as Paul didn't go through each one, and he did with the gifts, if you've got this gift, do this. If you got this, but with these character development things, it's going to come as we drive through life. We aren't to necessarily stress over this, but you're going to hear this list like all these people did in that church. The Jewish people that were all uptight because the other people didn't have the same rules and lifestyle, and the freewheeling party animals were just grateful that they were redeemed and in this group. And who, you're going to hear the list, and everybody's going to think, I could listen to that one. And, you know, over life, God's transforming us, and you don't even know it. So we do know, as we test and try God's will for us, which says that we're appropriating these things, we will know. We do know that His will for us, back in Romans 8, He's working all things out for good for those who are called according to His purpose, and His purpose is to make us like Christ. It's so far beyond any one of these things. And the person who is being transformed more and more is going to be able to rest in the certainty that God is making us like Christ. His plan is far, far more into the eternal perspective than any one of these things is addressing. Bad things can happen, and they will happen, but the biblical thinker, it is increasingly falling back on that eternal reality that God is doing a work, and He will complete it, that work that He started in us. And we can drive a long way on that truth. It's not how we feel. It is the truth. So, we can pray. I mean, that's one of the things we can do. Is pray for transformation. Y'all, I'm just going to turn the tape off, but we understand if you have trouble hearing us or something that you'll say goodbye, but thanks for joining us, you Zoom people. Turn this off. Thanks for joining us on the tape as well, if you did.